Hi, I'm Mickey Lowe.
Hi, I'm Bishop Todd.
And welcome to the C4SO podcast.
Mickey, great to see you today.
Yes, it's great to be here. I'm so excited for today's episode.
I know, this Lenten series is off to a good start, and yes. I'm excited about our guest today. Tell us a bit about our guest.
Yes, so our guest today is Alan Fadling, and we are discussing his approach to an unhurried life and how that translates into Lenten practices. So yeah. I'm excited about this one.
I know we range from kind of personal discipline to leadership issues to some important points of theology. And so we're very happy now for you to hear this episode of the C4SO podcast. Hey, Alan, welcome to the show. It's good for me to see your face, but I've seen your face for a number of years now. We're old friends. Yes. Some of our listeners wouldn't know that, but give everybody a hint of how you and I connected.
Well, I could tell a long version of the story, but I'll stick with a short one. You know, gosh, it's been 8 years ago. We were in a little bit of a church crisis. You know, where's church home for us? And the ones we were in just didn't feel like they were quite home. Came, visited Holy Trinity in Costa Mesa, California. And our first 10 minutes in that first service, we looked at each other and go, oh, we're Anglicans. That's what it is. So that's the story.
We've had enough lunches for me to know your story, that you didn't come to your work in unhurried living, unhurried leadership out of the blue. You came to it from a story in which you had been working with church leaders. Yeah. I remember you telling me many times how grateful you were for two or three people who had been mentors in your life and that you were working with them to mentor others. So tell people a bit of your story so that they can understand the kind of raw material from which you're thinking about this has come.
You know, I figured out here recently that as we're talking, I've been in paid ministry exactly 40 years. About half of that first half was in local church, mostly as an associate with young adults, youth. And then the second half of that has been more in an itinerant mentoring, coaching, and more recently writing kind of role. And so this idea of hurry comes both from my personal experience of hitting some near burnout in my later 20s, which is really bad timing. You know, if you're burning out in your 20s, something is not
well
paid.
Yeah, you were special, Alan.
Yeah. I'm really good at this, you know. But I began to realize a lot of other younger leaders had this sort of pacing that made no sense at all. No sense in terms of personal wellness, no sense in terms of kingdom cooperation, just no sense at all. And so thanks, as you say, to some mentors, I began to walk in in the spirit of what came to be known as spiritual formation in the Protestant church. Yeah. And later I began to realize unhurried, thanks to Dallas's comments and others, really made sense for the transition I found myself in. And so I came to think, you know, Jesus was unhurried in the best sense of that word. He had time for people. I was often running past people to do things. Yeah. He had time for prayer. It seemed to keep getting squeezed out of my schedule. So that began to shape my imagination for this unhurried way.
Yeah, thank you.
As a church planter myself, as I was working through your book, An Unhurried Life, I felt really compelled because so many times we try to squeeze as much work as we can into our schedules for the sake of the kingdom, we tell ourselves, but in reality, we end up getting really burnt out. And so we'll get into your book in just a second, but I would love to hear about some of your first experiences with Lent, because this episode is a part of our Lenten series. And so I would just love to hear your thoughts.
Absolutely. Having kind of grown up in the non-liturgical church for many decades, Lent was a thing that other people did. You know, it wasn't part of my experience. But as I began to step into it, I came to love the rhythms of the year. I came to love the idea of preparing for Easter instead of Easter being this big blowout one-day thing that happens in the end. There was this journey to Easter that we were taking, and there was this preparation, sort of John the Baptist-like, for the celebration of Christ's resurrection. And so, you know, I've had a lot of different focus points in terms of my experience of Lent. Sometimes it's been a literal fasting sort of rhythm. I've often taken, though, more of an unhurried sort of approach in the sense of pausing some of my normal engagements I think that's one of the ways to think about Lent in terms of hurry and unhurried. So sometimes that's involved my intake level of media or my engagement level with devices. That has helped open up space. That perhaps for me is the biggest thing, is that Lent has opened up space for me to remember what matters, to notice God with me, and to prepare well for the celebration of He is risen.
That's awesome. One of the things that really stood out to me in chapter 3 of An Unhurried Life is you say this, good work grows best in the soil of good rest. And as church leaders, or even Christians just trying to live a faithful life, that's really powerful. Because again, we try to fill up as much of our schedules as we can for work of the kingdom. But in reality, the best work for the kingdom grows from the soil of good rest. And so kind of connecting this unhurried way of living with the season of Lent, why do you think Lent gives us the opportunity to set this rhythm? And how does Lent give us kind of a framework for thinking through how to live in an unhurried way?
Yeah, so I think, again, Lent is one of those disciplines that has to do with not doing something. And a lot of times we measure our work by the things we do. And of course, God has given us good things to do. But it's sort of like breathing. You know, if you decided that breathing is only exhaling, that's not going to work very well for very long. You're going to need to inhale and exhale. You're going to need to rest and work. And by rest, I don't just mean get enough sleep. You should. That's good for you. It's God-given. But I'm talking about that rest for our souls that Jesus speaks of. I just think we're living in a day where maybe the world most needs us to live well the rhythms of work and rest that Jesus models, that the kingdom invites us to. I think the world may desperately need us to be more restful in our souls than we sometimes have been. That may be a facet of the gospel, of the good news, that the world may come to realize it really needs. And so I think Lent, like many other spiritual disciplines, is a way of protecting space from my impulse to fill it with stuff to do.
Yeah, I was going to say, Alan, that is a really interesting connection you're making, like missional rest or ministerial rest, that actually it's a witness to the world. It's to think of Newbegin's language, it's a sign, it's a foretaste of the kingdom to come when Christians are living in like the God-ordained Sabbath. And that, I guess, not just a witness or a testimony, but also might itself be healing. That's really interesting that you put that together.
Yeah.
Mission and rest.
I think that's important, because otherwise sometimes what we end up with is this vision of rest that's disengaged or disconnected from fruitful engagement in what God's given us to do. We don't have a vision or an imagination for how work and rest integrate, like how rest might be sort of the beating heart of the work that I do. Yeah. They're one thing and not two islands I sort of shuttle back and forth between.
Yeah. Usually this lives in my mind in a very playful, evocative way, where Eugene Peterson said, we don't want to constantly be resting from a harried work. We want to work from essential rest. So sometimes that's really playful and evocative in me, and I love it. And other times I just feel so guilty, like, oh God, nobody tell Eugene how I'm actually living. I mean, we can't do that now, but but years before I would have thought that. And so I think I'm just getting at that rhythm you're talking about, Alan, that we don't want to constantly be like falling down on the sofa of life, exhausted, can't do another thing.
Right.
We actually want to, you remember Peterson uses that story of Moby Dick, and the harpooners of this world have to rise from stillness.
Yeah.
And so doing our life from that kind of, and ministry from that inner stillness is a really beautiful picture to me. And it's great that you point out that that has like ministerial, pastoral, missional implications.
Coach John Wooden used to tell his players, you know, be quick, but don't hurry.
I knew where you were going. I was a big Wooden fan.
Right. I mean, that's such a great way to say it, because there is a quick that is Jesus-like, responsive, not slow to respond to opportunities that the Spirit brings to us. But again, hurry is talking about what's happening in me when I do those things and when I respond. And so I just think, it's so important. There's a critical difference between work that grows in the soil of rest and a vision of rest that's the collapse when I have, when I'm out of gas. I got nothing left, which is usually not all that restful anyway, you know, in the end.
Right. The idea is not to come to a place of burnout and then say, oh, I need rest. The idea is to build these rhythms so that we don't reach that point. So.
Yes, that's well said.
Yeah. And I think that also requires us to kind of reframe how we think about rest and kind of slowing down. I really love the story that you briefly mentioned about your friend doing ministry work in Buenos Aires, Argentina, which is actually where I'm originally from.
Is that right?
Yeah, my ears perked up. I was like, ooh, because I was listening to the audiobook. But you say that your friend kind of reported back and was like, the hustle and bustle of city life is associated with survival. We often don't think about rest being our way of healthily surviving, and the work that we do being produced by soil that is well rested. Because a lot of the times we associate rest with laziness, and that's one of the other things you bring up. And it requires us to kind of reframe the way that we think about rest.
Another way to say this is in many, many people's imagination, rest is really little more than the word work with a red slash through it. It's just, it's a negation.
Right.
It's a not work. Rest is not work, which is not at all the same as rest is refreshment. It's renewal. It's enjoyment of the God who's made us. It's remembering I first am who God says I am, and then I go out and do things with God that he's invited me to do. So it gets down into the soil of identity. It gets down into the soil of who am I as a human person? And first I am a friend of Jesus, and then I'm a collaborator with Jesus. And both of those are honored, honored relationships I get to enjoy.
You bring up the story of Abraham and Sarah and their impatience with conceiving children and the long-term effect of that hurried decision that they made. What would you say are some of the dangers that a hurried life kind of poses to us now? What are some of the ways that we can get ahead of ourselves or not build these rhythms? What are the dangers of that in our world today?
You know, it makes me think of a line I think I quoted in the first book. Vincent de Paul, you know, from a few centuries back, used to say, or said at least once, the one who hurries delays the things of God. And I think I've seen too often that my knee-jerk reactive sort of initiatives sometimes create situations where God has to do more to get me to where I was hoping to go, where slowing down and waiting and being attentive and watching for, like the harpooner, watching for the moment, has been quicker. It has been more productive. It's been a better cooperative mode, cooperative mode with God. I think there's all kinds of dangers. Part of it lies in the roots of what hurry is in our lives. For some of us, it looks like anxiety. Anxiety has not usually led me to great decision making. I've often jumped at the first thing that came to mind, and it's rarely been the best option before me. Sometimes hurry looks like a desperate need to be recognized by the people around me, also leading me to poor decision-making. Sometimes it's looked like a belief in the culture's value that I am what I have. And so, but what I have needs to be, you know, church successes measured in certain ways. All of these lead me in a kind of hurried way to unwise decision-making. And I don't have the kingdom in mind as much as when I'm at peace or when I'm secure in the presence of God. Or when I realize I can be content with what God's given me. These are postures from which I can be unhurried and wiser.
Hello, Eric Vinson here, C4SO's Director of Administration, inviting all C4SO clergy, staff, spouses, and children to this year's clergy conference at Christ Church Overland Park, May 3rd through 5th. There will be food, fellowship, and fun. What's not to love? In our sessions, we'll be exploring the theme, Confident Ministry, Faithfully Navigating Our Times, targeting three specific areas of our current cultural landscape: marginalization of the church, gender identity and transgender experiences, and political disunity. Our keynote speaker, Bishop Todd Hunter, alongside psychologist Mark Yarhouse, will specifically address pastoral implications and practical takeaways. Register now at c4so.org to take advantage of early bird pricing. If you register after February 28th, the price increases to $329 per adult. So don't wait. Register today, and we hope to see you in May.
I hear you saying something really important, Alan, that when we think of being, you know, non-anxious or unhurried, that sort of thing, that can often feel kind of pietistic. I mean that in the good sense of the term, meaning it can feel like it fits in a category of spiritual formation or spiritual transformation or discipleship or Christian maturity. But I hear you saying that there's actually a practical connection between unhurriedness and Christian leadership. And since most of the people who listen to this podcast are Christian leaders of some sort or another, just say a bit more about that, how unhurried or hurriedness and whatever the underlying drivers are, as you were just saying, like give us an example of how it's maybe caused relational problems or led to bad decisions or inadvertently bullying a vestry or a staff or whatever. Give us, you know, you've coached so many people. Give us a, I want everybody to see the connection you're making clearly.
Yeah. So I was just speaking to a group of leaders in Atlanta here a week or two ago. And one of the gentlemen there, he happens to work out in the business world, but he gave a great illustration because I was talking about hurry and leadership. He said, yeah, you know, I lost my temper with one of the guys who reports to me. And it took a day and a half before we got back to normal, to where we could work together again. I lost a day and a half of time because I lost my temper in a moment.
Yeah.
I mean, just that kind of stuff doesn't just happen in business, you know?
Yeah, right.
That happens in Christian leadership all the time. We, in our various flavors of soul hurry, in my anxiety, in my desperate need for other people to approve of me or affirm me, in my belief that I am how I do leading a church, in all of those things, I think I lose track of that which matters most. I think I lose track of that to which God has invited me. And I think one of the other things that has really struck me is who I am when I do what I do makes an immense amount of difference. Like, I've led ministries from a place of deep anxiety, and I've led ministries from a place of deep peace. And I know the difference between the fruit that those two modes bear. I know the difference. I feel it.
And Alan, I think you would agree with me that it's not just the external differences in the fruit, but there's internal differences in kind of the fruit, you know, thinking of like Galatians 5, in our own soul, that we can cultivate impatience, we can cultivate unkindness, we can cultivate lots of the things of the flesh, as Paul says, by giving into the kind of anxious, defensive hurriedness, is that there's both internal and external bad fruits when we give into the reverse.
No, that's exactly right. So I was talking with a pastor, and she's in the Minneapolis area. We were talking about long-term planning. It was an interesting conversation. Mm-hmm. And what she came to was, what would it look like if my long-term plan, instead of being largely organizational, measured in dollars and buildings and programs and such, I wonder what it would look like if the fruit of the Spirit was the primary measure of our long-term plan. Like, who are, not just who am I becoming as a pastor, but who are we becoming as a community?
Yeah.
And there's an odd way in which some of the antithesis of the fruit of the Spirit is actually in our cultural vision, leadership virtues.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't think that's the way the kingdom works.
So, Mickey, I know you're a church planter in Tampa because I just visited you guys. Yeah. I'm wondering, you know, everybody knows the iconic version of, you know, a kind of out of control, busy church planter in those first few years. How are you hearing this? What are you thinking?
I'm just so compelled by this conversation and honestly really convicted too, because I think that, you know, we lead the best out of a place of peace, out of being filled with the Spirit. We lead best when we are not at the very end of ourselves. And unfortunately for me, it's happened a couple times, more than a couple times in my first year planting with my husband, because, you know, it's all brand new. And there's so many roles you take on as a church planter. You do things that you just never imagined yourself doing. Like, we were gifted with a building this past year is not the sort of thing that we imagined for our first year of church planting, but God blessed us through some really generous folks. But my husband and I found ourselves being general contractors. We know nothing about buildings. We knew nothing about renovating old church buildings, but that's where we found ourselves because the Lord, you know, in his goodness blessed us with this and he called us to help restore this building so that our church could meet there. And so because we did not really manage our time super well, we had no idea what we were doing. We kind of found ourselves reaching our limit very quickly after we closed on this building. And so had I already been in the habit and the practice of building rhythms of rest into my life, I don't think that I would have gotten burned out so much during that period of time. So this whole conversation I think is really valuable for people who are in ministry, whether that's vocationally or in a lay capacity, but especially church leaders who are finding themselves in a season where they're taking on a lot of roles, which happens a lot in church planting. This sort of conversation is super valuable. And especially leading up to the season of Lent, you know, I hope that during this time we can really put into practice these sort of rhythms that we're speaking about. So it's super valuable to me as a planter right now.
Well, I love that. I mean, there's no question planting a church. Oh my goodness. I have never been the primary church planter, but I've been on two different teams planning churches, and I know how much work it is. And the thing is, you know, I think what we have to do is we have to realize hard work is not just adding.
Right.
Because that's a recipe for burnout. Right. Hard work has a way of practicing rhythms of receptivity that lead to fruitful activity. Mm-hmm. It's that receptivity that practices like Lent or solitude or silence or fasting. They make space. They open up space for us to notice, to remember who we are, to notice who God is, to notice perhaps how God is present or giving us counsel. And then we work. And I find that my anxiety is what more often than anything makes the yoke heavy, not always just the long list of tasks I might be doing in a particular season.
Let's stop there for a minute, Alan. That's super helpful. I think we can all feel the effect of a long to-do list on the notes app on our phone or a piece of paper on our desk.
Guilty.
And what I hear you saying is what we bring to that list can be as anxiety and hurried producing as the list itself.
Well, I've been playing with that a little bit lately because I've been doing some writing work on anxiety, which is my soul. That's what hurry looks like most often in my leadership soul. Mm-hmm. And so I realized in my imagination, what I will do is I've got a big to-do list, but I let it all land on me in the present moment. Like everything that I have coming up is here now.
Yeah.
Like I'm practicing the presence of my to-do list instead of practicing the presence of God in the task or project or meeting now that I'm doing.
Yeah.
Like there's
so
a
good.
Huge difference between
yeah,
those.
So
and
good.
So otherwise, then I end up just feeling like this, I see this vision of day upon day piled too high with stuff to do. When in fact, that's not at all what my future looks like, even in a busy season.
I'll just be vulnerable. My most difficult moments that are anxiety producing and that would drive me into hurry is looking at those lists and feeling hopeless. Like I look at the list and then I look at my Google Calendar and I see there's no more room, but the list is still there.
Yep.
Man, that can drive me into not so good places, you know,
Oh, gosh,
in terms of anxiety, hurry, fear, whatever, defeat, you know.
Absolutely. No, I resonate with that. And so, you know, I forget where I heard it. Might have even been Dallas said it once. But, you know, I have all of the time I need for that which God has actually given me to do.
Yeah.
God has not overloaded me. So that just gives me an opportunity to discern, you know, is there something that I can hand to another? Is there something I shouldn't be giving as much time to as perhaps I am?
Yeah.
It's an opportunity for discernment, I think.
Hey, let's talk a bit about your new book, A Year of Slowing Down. Most recently for InterVarsity Press, you so kindly signed a copy for me. And I've been looking at it and working with it. So it's one thing to ask an author, you know, what were you trying to say? What did you mean by it? It's another thing to ask an author, what were you trying to do? What were you hoping this book would accomplish? So as the author, say a bit about how you thought this book would work for people and what it might accomplish in their lives.
Yeah. So in some ways, this is really the third book in the trilogy, the Unhurried Trilogy. So Life, Leader, and now A Year of Slowing Down. The first two were books talking about the issue of hurry. What I really hoped this book would be was a book that would help over the course of a year, help people to slow down, to actually do that.
Yeah.
So that was in my mind. I had this imagination that I was writing daily 5-minute retreats. Mm. I want leaders to even if just 5 minutes to stop, to read a text, to read a little thought, and to have a question to take into their day that I hope would be the kind of question that it's not the kind of question you just answer, good, the end, next.
Yeah.
But it's a kind of question you can live with. So that was my hope. I really had a vision of how could I actually help people slow down through the vehicle of a devotional. It just, it's a way of reading that's different than the other two books were.
Do you think your book works equally well as Examine in the evening, or do you think people would engage with it better as a way, like you said, of taking a reality through their day as they're beginning it? And I ask because I hope all of our listeners will get your book, and I just want them to have a sense of how it might work.
I think it would work either way. I probably imagined people reading it as their day began.
Okay.
But that being said, I often am thinking of my next day the evening before.
Right.
That's one of my practices. I think of the work of the day, and that's something I do prayerfully each evening. So this book would work then too.
Yeah.
The question would simply be something I sleep on and then wake to and bring into the day. And the other thing I'll say is, you know, in many ways, I could imagine a book like this doing something like what Lent does for us. Again, the point being space over time to cultivate a receptive posture before God.
Yeah. So just drip by drip, little by little, over a course of a year.
Yeah.
Looking for an adjustment in our heart. That's great.
Yeah. That's what I was hoping.
So Alan, I'm curious to hear your thoughts on what sort of practices would you recommend to someone who is really looking to soak in the Lenten season and is really looking to set these rhythms of an unhurried life. So personally, because I live in the city of Tampa, within the city limits, my life is very fast paced just by the nature of where I live. And as much as my family and I love the place that we're rooted in, we have found it necessary for our family to retreat at least a few times a year to the mountains or Ocala National Forest. My husband and I kind of decided that was going to be part of our rule of life because it was those times where we retreated that we got a sense of refreshment. And so we try to make that a priority for our family. It's a practice for us. So what other sort of practices would you recommend to someone who's looking to set these rhythms in their life?
One of the ways I'd like to think about Lent is it's saying what may be a relatively small little no day after day for a number of weeks that opens up space for me to say the yes that I want to be able to say.
Yeah.
And so one way you could ask the question as you prepare for Lent, what is a no God might be inviting me to say? Is it a daily no? Is it some sort of rhythm in my day that I don't do something I usually do? The thing I don't do doesn't have to be a bad thing.
Right.
You know, fasting is just I don't eat like I normally eat, or solitude, I'm not with folks like I usually am. So I think there's ways in which you could think about Lent in a daily way. You could also think of it in a weekly sort of way. Maybe Sabbath just hasn't been a regular practice in the way you'd like it to be. So maybe you say no once a week to a day in which, you know, you're tempted to do regular work, to use that phrase from the Old Testament. Well, to experiment with establishing a Sabbath practice, if it hasn't been in place, where you try on what it's like to live through a day where you're not measuring your performance. You don't have to get stuff done. What does that feel like? I do think the big idea of what is the no God might be inviting me to say is a good prayerful place to start. And it's where I've often started when I think about my own Lenten practice.
So Alan, we want to ask you lastly about what your practice for Lent's going to be this year, just so people can have some idea. But before we get there, just listening to you and Mickey there reminded me that people like you and me and John Ortberg and John Mark Comer and others were all riffing on, you know, what Dallas had scrawled across his day timer back when people had day planners, ruthlessly eliminate hurry.
Yeah.
And hearing you just reminds me that there are kind of legalistic ways of getting at that, technical, you know, like techniques. And then there's more heartfelt ways of doing it. Where have you seen leaders go wrong when they are not able to get to the heart issues of ruthlessly eliminating hurry, right? Like ruthless almost sounds like the Pharisees and the Sadducees or something, right? Like
putting
heavy burdens on people's shoulders. But we all know Dallas was getting at something different than that. So say a bit about how you've seen leaders struggle with and or, you know, break free of the struggle to eliminate hurry.
Well, I think in all of that, one of the great challenges is being practice focused instead of being God focused. You know, we tend to then, well, it's very easy to get focused on I'm the one who's fasting, you know, or I'm the one who's practicing solitude or silence. It's an oddly me-focused thing. That has not led to good places for me.
Yeah.
So part of what I think, whatever our Lenten practices are, is, again, it's meant to be a kind of more intensified God-focused season. And the God I'm focusing on turns out to be a God who longs to be gracious, who delights in mercy, who is very slow to anger. And so who I'm focusing on in these practices has a way of transforming who I am as I engage those practices. That's made a huge difference for me. I've also been the leader in the past where I was trying to practice heroic disciplines because I just wanted everyone to think I was the most spiritual guy in the room.
Yeah.
And that didn't bear very good fruit.
Yeah. That's so important, Alan. I hear you saying that when my spiritual practices are either, you know, thinking of the Sermon on the Mount to be seen by others, or maybe they're shame-based or rooted in guilt or rooted in a kind of, I'm reacting to some sort of internal desperation, I hear you saying that the practicing unhurried living rooted in those things is a vastly, wildly different thing than practicing this with reference to our good, gracious, long-suffering Father, and that alone will make the difference of the outcomes. Am I hearing you?
That's exactly right. So, you know, to me now, phrases like Paul to Timothy, grow in grace.
Yeah.
How's that happening? How do you do that?
Yeah.
Do you read another book about grace? I mean, that's good. By all means, be a learner, but you grow in grace by letting your life in all the ways it needs to be graced to be in the presence of the God of grace.
Yeah.
And then you become gracious with others because you've learned to let God be gracious with you. And these practices, Lent and the others, just open up space, like Nouwen once said, opens up space for us to notice the God who was gracious with us.
That'd be a great headline for everybody.
Yes.
Lent 2023 : opening space.
Yes.
That'd be a great Lenten theme for anybody and any church.
Yeah.
Well,
yes.
Alan, we're so grateful for your work. So great for Mickey and I to be able to talk with you today. I know Jim couldn't be with us, but grateful for her work as well. And I know she writes and you guys write together. You guys have become, your little house there in Irvine's becoming like a literary factory, man.
That's awesome.
I would never have guessed this 10 years ago. I'm just telling you.
All right. Aww. So before we let you go, we got to put you on the hook one last time. What are you going to do for Lent this year and why?
I'm still wrestling with a few different things. But I think what it'll probably be is disengaging from some of my habits with media and devices. I mean, I'm a child of the 70s. I helped build computers in high school. I love technology. I just can't keep my fingers off it. So that's a shiny little bauble that I need to let go of at times. So often it's something like that.
So Mickey, let me give you the last word here. What are you thinking or feeling?
I actually need to think through what my Lenten practices will be this year myself. So these are all great things to kind of prompt that thought process. So yeah, I'm excited for this season and I'm really excited to have this time be kind of a gift for those who are trying to think through this.
Yeah. Amen. Alan, thanks so much for your life. Thanks so much for your work. Thanks for sharing it with the C4SO audience. We're really appreciative.
It was great to be with you both. Thanks.
Thanks so much for tuning in to the C4SO podcast. If you like what you heard, please feel free to share this episode and subscribe and leave a review. It helps us to get the word out. Thanks.